I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and this is an episode of Worldwise, where we try to check in with people in other parts of the world and find out how things look there. And you're in New Delhi, which is certainly another part of the world. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Saman Subramanian. I'm one of the two India correspondents for The National. The National is a newspaper based in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi. So I live in Delhi and I cover politics and economics for them. I also write occasionally for the New York Times blog on India. It's called India Inc. And I write book reviews for The Guardian occasionally and sort of long-form narrative pieces for a magazine called Caravan. So I cover a lot of subjects when I do all this, but it's I write mostly about Indian politics, Indian economics, and India's place in the world.
Okay. Now, I know that one thing that has gotten a little bit of discussion in India lately has to do with the Olympics, which wound up earlier this week. And apparently India suffers from low per capita medal count. Is that right?
That's right. India came away from the London Olympics with 6 medals, 2 silvers and 4 bronzes, which is incidentally its best performance in the Olympics till date. Mm-hmm. And so an optimist might see this as an improvement, but you're right, as a per capita figure, it's not exactly a great
show. Because your population is, what, 3 or 4 times America's, 1.2 billion or something like that?
That's right.
Okay. So I assume there's been a certain amount of hand-wringing about this, and maybe this is a ritual there that you do every 4 years.
That's actually true. I mean, this is turning out to be a sort of quadrennial postmortem that the Indian press and Indian sports lovers do after every Olympics. And, you know, people try to analyze sort of the reasons behind India's miserable performance in the Olympics. And it's usually tracked back to 2 or 3 things every time. The first is, of course, just the sheer dominance that cricket has in India in terms of, both in terms of exciting young sportsmen and young Indians, but also the sheer amount of money that it attracts in terms of investment from the government, as well as in terms of sponsorship from corporations. A couple of the other reasons that come up every 4 years, one of them is a lack of infrastructure, sporting infrastructure in grassroots India. My fellow correspondent and I spoke to somebody at an athletics club in Kerala. And this is a South Indian state. It's produced quite a few fine sprinters over the last 20 or 30 years. But somebody at the club was telling us about how their students still train on mud tracks. And to compete on synthetic tracks, which is usually what international sprinters run on, they actually have to go and train in another town, in another state altogether, 4 hours away. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of an example of the lack of infrastructure that exists at the grassroots. One could also point maybe to a lack of investment on the part of the government, but that is increasing. I mean, compared to 20 years ago, the amount of money that the government spends on sporting facilities and on its athletes and its sportsmen and sportswomen, that's definitely increasing. Maybe it's not at the level where it should be, but it has grown sort of decade on decade.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, does India pay much attention to the Olympics? I mean, I would think if their prospects for winning with frequency are that low, that maybe you wouldn't see a lot of people tuning in.
I don't know if that's true. I think a lot of people, I mean, I think it's a pretty, it does very well on television. You know, in fact, much of the 20th century, the Indian field hockey team used to dominate the Olympics in that particular sport. And mm-hmm. I think between in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, they won all but 3 gold medals that were on offer there. And there were a couple of other athletes who used to do very well for India in international sports. So there were, you know, sort of there were these slivers of hope to which Indian sports lovers would look. And I think at least in the last 2 Olympics, there have been a number of Indian athletes whose names have now become well known among the Indian population at large. So they definitely tune in to see them win. There was a boxer from India's northeast, Mary Kom, who won one of India's medals in this Olympics. And sort of the day she won was a you know, as far as Twitter is a barometer of anything, you know, it was very evident that a lot of people were watching and following the Olympics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I would assume that India's great rival in athletics is Pakistan. Is that right? I mean, could a lot of Indians tell you offhand how many Olympic medals Pakistan won?
I don't think so. I mean, I think if the sort of the ardent Indian nationalist has any smidgen of hope to take away from the Olympics on a year-on-year basis, it's probably that India does better than Pakistan. So I think India and Pakistan compete very vigorously in cricket and to a lesser extent in hockey. But I think, you know, in other disciplines like boxing and athletics, I don't think Pakistan is much of a competitor. And India has not until recently been much of a competitor as well. So I don't think people are tracking the Pakistani medal count too closely at all.
Mm-hmm. And I guess India will not be angling to host an Olympics anytime soon until it gets more competitive at least?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. People do anticipate that within the next 20 years, India will put in a serious bid. India hosted the Commonwealth Games in 2010, which is a tournament, you know, played by members of the former British Commonwealth, and 50 or so nations come and compete there. So that's a far cry from the number of countries that an Olympic city hosts. Mm-hmm. And there were sort of serious doubts about how well New Delhi pulled it off. You know, in hindsight, everything looked fine, but there were serious hiccups on the way to the preparation to host this event. But there is talk. I mean, I do think that in the next 20 years, there will be some sort of serious bid put forward. If not necessarily for sporting status, then definitely to sort of validate India's status as a large democratic country that has arrived, quote-unquote, on the world stage. These are not my thoughts. These are thoughts that are put forward very frequently in the media.
Right. And I would think the Chinese Olympics of a few years ago are relevant, right? I mean, that was thought of as a kind of a coming-of-age ritual for China, you know, that affirms its economic development and so on. And, of course, in America at least, China and India are also often talked about in the same breath as two countries that were formerly extremely, you know, underdeveloped economically, have developed very rapidly. Are Indians very conscious of the comparison, maybe even in a competitive way, with China?
I don't think there's a sort of a single answer to that. I mean, if you had to divide Indian society up into segments, I mean, I think there would be certain segments that do think about China very often. I think the Indian media, for example, is very often obsessed with this duality of India and China. I think Indian politicians are very conscious of China, both in terms of a strategic geopolitical neighbor, but also in terms of an economic competitor. You'll hear a lot of Indian politicians kind of referring to China and Chinese economic growth. We had a recent chief minister of the state of Maharashtra who had promised to make Bombay or Mumbai India's Shanghai. Mm-hmm. It's a promise we're still waiting to see to its fruition. It hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. But I think by and large, if you talk to the average Indian and you probed for any evidence of this obsession with China, I'm not sure you would find it. There is a general awareness about the fact that India and China are not quite competing on the same plank. I think there's a certain awareness about how China has achieved its economic growth and the sacrifices that it's had to make, particularly in terms of democracy and freedom of speech, both of which are still highly valued in India. Mm-hmm. So I get the feeling, at least in talking to, as I said, the average Indian, that people know that the playing field is not exactly the same. It's not level, and there's, each country should be measured by a different yardstick.
Okay. And how would you assess the state of economic development broadly in India? I mean, in America, there has for some years now been the perception of rapid economic development. A lot of software development. There are Americans who fear losing their jobs to Indians. Maybe some who believe they already have. But I think there's a larger picture there, right? I mean, there are a lot of people in India, and not all of them are writing software right now. So, what would you say about the overall stage of development?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's been an interesting 10 years. If you had to ask me this question in 2000 or 2001, you know, I would have sort of conveyed a sentiment of largely of optimism. I think about 10 years ago, I think there was a certain belief or an assumption that economic growth of 9 or 10%, which is sort of the holy grail of Indian economic planning right now, economic growth at that level would be able to lift a large number of Indians, millions of Indians out of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
They would be able to cut through a lot of the bureaucracy and red tape and corruption that we've traditionally known in Indian government. And that it would serve as sort of a panacea to all of the country's ills. I think a realization is, you know, particularly over the last 2 or 3 years, I think there has been a certain realization that that along with economic reform and economic growth, there needs to be a certain amount of structural and political reform, and that hasn't happened yet. And I think that mood of 2000, 2001, that mood of optimism has definitely, you know, been tempered by a certain amount of realism. Particularly in the reign of this current government, which is led by Manmohan Singh, an economist.
Mm-hmm.
And over the last 2 or 3 years, unfortunately, this government has proven itself capable of a great deal of governmental mismanagement, and especially of a great deal of corruption. And I think a lot of people are beginning to realize now that economic growth alone is not going to solve those two big problems.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about structural reform, are you mainly talking about anti-corruption initiatives and anti-red tape initiatives?
That's one part of it, and that's definitely something that is in the public mood a lot. Over the last year, for example, there has been a Gandhian activist from the state of Maharashtra who has led, you know, a large number of rallies in cities across India where he drew thousands of people. You know, he went on hunger fasts all to pressure the government and to pressure parliament into passing a certain anti-corruption bill. That bill has still not been passed, and all this fasting and protesting has not had the intended effect. And in fact, only a couple of weeks ago, this particular activist decided that he was going to transform his movement into a political one. He's going to start a political party. So as a result of all these events, I think, and a number of ministers in the government have recently, over the last 2 years, had to resign or have gone to prison, again, over corruption allegations. So as a result of all this, I think corruption is definitely uppermost in a lot of people's minds today. The corruption is also tied to a certain amount of crony capitalism. And so there's that particular structural reform that I think people would love to see, is to break this nexus between politics and corporations. I think these two things, and I would say that a lot of India's worries are also tied to the mismanagement of policy. But I think people see these two things as being allied issues, and I think they see reform as handling both of them at the same time, which would kind of solve a lot of economic and policy problems that India is facing today.
Mm-hmm. So there's not so much agitation for income redistribution, progressive taxation, that kind of thing?
No, I mean, it's definitely not a popular plank. I mean, there may be sort of policy wonks who are arguing for progressive taxation. India still has, I wouldn't call them a vibrant left party, but they definitely have communist parties who contest elections on a regular basis, and they win elections on a regular basis, at least in the state level. And they, of course, call for income redistribution and for a rollback of all the liberalization and opening up of the economy that has happened over the last 20 years. So these debates still do thrive in the public sphere. But again, if you had to ask me about what is uppermost in people's minds, I would probably go back to corruption and policy mismanagement.
Because, I mean, there is tremendous income inequality in India, right?
That's right. I mean, and the income inequality has only widened over the last 20 years. I think there's an economic theory out there that says that this is natural, that, you know, income inequality will widen before it goes back down as GDP and economic growth increase. So you know, a lot of economic theorists would point to this particular theory. I can't remember the name of the economist who proposed this off the top of my head. But they would point to this theory and say that this is just the natural progression of things. But it's undoubtedly very painful and frustrating to live through, especially if you are you know, in sort of the bottom 10 or 20% of the Indian population in terms of income and wealth.
Mm-hmm. And how much of the income inequality is correlated with caste? I mean, of course, caste no longer has any legal significance in India, right? I mean,
that's right.
But I assume there's still a certain amount of consciousness of it. You tell me.
I would say that's true. I think there's a certain amount of consciousness of caste. I think there's also there continues to be, although maybe not to the extent of how much there was 50 years ago, but there continues to be an overlap between the caste hierarchy and the economic hierarchy. And so if you look at people who are at the bottom of the economic ladder, invariably they will, unfortunately, turn out to be people at the bottom of the caste ladder. And this applies particularly when you move out of the Indian cities and go into sort of villages where the caste system has been much harder to break. These are traditions in a lot of rural India, and so they have been very difficult to break. To a certain extent, the mobility that a city offers the average Indian has enabled him or her to break out of the caste ladder. Mm-hmm. But that straitjacket still remains in large parts of India.
But there's not much agitation for something like affirmative action?
It actually does happen. A lot of, you know, a number of government positions are reserved. Government employment is reserved based on caste for backward castes. A lot of educational institutions practice affirmative action, particularly the ones that are run by the government. And in fact, this has been a policy that's been in place for a long time. And I think a lot of people who would try to look for reasons as to why this caste system has at least been eliminated to a certain extent would point to the mobility that has been afforded by affirmative action as one of the reasons. I mean, the fact that a lot of people who are formerly of the lower castes could go to university and get an education and go out and get a job that is not tied to their caste status. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that has definitely liberated a lot of people from the chains of caste. There's still a long way to go in affirmative action. But affirmative action has been in place for around at least 40 years in my home state of Tamil Nadu, for example, in South India.
I see.
And so it's definitely one of the reasons behind the newfound mobility of some of the lower castes.
I see. And I assume, you know, there's a pretty big Indian diaspora in the United States. Certainly where I live in central New Jersey, there are a lot of people from India. You know, my daughter has a friend whose parents immigrated from India. He's a cardiologist mm-hmm. here. There's a lot of that. I assume that mm-hmm. most of the people we see in America who are from India are from the upper caste.
That would be correct. I mean, they would be people who had the sort of the resources to go abroad. I mean, they would probably have gone abroad to study mm-hmm. Before then sort of settling down and finding employment there. And it was not, I mean, you know, back then in the 1960s and 70s, when a lot of people like my uncles, for example, when they emigrated, it was not cheap. I mean, it's still not cheap for a lot of people who are earning a salary in Indian rupees to finance a U.S. education that often runs into tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. This is an expensive proposition. And so you're right. I mean, many of the people you know, would probably be from the upper castes, people who had the resources to, you know, go mm-hmm. abroad, or alternatively, who had been educated well enough to earn a scholarship or a fellowship in the university mm-hmm. that they attended. And again, 60 or 40 or 50 years ago, the people who had been educated that well would have been from the upper castes.
Mm-hmm. And this question just occurred to me, but I assume that caste is something that only has relevance within the Hindu segment of the Indian population. In other words, it's not relevant to Muslim society, or am I wrong?
On paper, you're right. I mean, you know, Islam or Buddhism or any of the other religions don't have a caste system within them. What unfortunately does happen is that, you know, a lot of the people in the Hindu lower castes, for this reason, convert to Muslim, to Islam or Christianity.
Is that right?
They do, figuring that, you know, they will get a better deal in a religion that is not caste-based. Mm-hmm. The unfortunate thing about Christianity and Islam in India is that they often, you know, the taint of caste often carries over. You know, because if a large number of Hindus convert, you know, the sense of the caste hierarchy still exists when you move back into Christianity, when you move back into Islam. These are very difficult shackles to throw off. I mean, they've been, you know, the caste system has been around for thousands of years, and it's very difficult to change that within a few generations. So you do, when you talk to, for example, when you talk to people of the Christian faith in India, again, particularly outside the cities, or if you talk to people who are Muslims outside the cities, I mean, they will talk about the fact that there are lower caste Muslims and lower caste Christians. These are not codified castes. I mean, you know, Christianity does not put these castes down on paper, but it's more a hangover from their Hindu roots.
So you mean they will describe themselves that way?
They will describe themselves that way. There will be certain discriminations that play in, because again, you know, if the sense of hierarchy has been carried over into the next into another religion, then the discriminations that come with that hierarchy continue to be carried over as well. So, in interpersonal interaction, for example, a higher caste Christian would behave a certain way towards a lower caste Christian, even though in the Hindu scheme of things, they may both have been in the lowest sort of two tiers or three tiers of Hindu caste. When they convert, that relative sense of hierarchy is still carried over.
So what's an example of a behavior that would be kind of caste determined in that context?
Well, profession would be one. I mean, traditionally, a lot of caste, the caste hierarchy has been rooted in what job you do. And this is something that you can find in the oldest Hindu texts, the Vedas. So, for example, a lower caste, people from among the lowest castes in Hinduism would work with animal hides. They would be cobblers or tanners. They would work with leather because it was considered impure or unclean to work with the carcasses of dead animals. So so a lot of the people who are in the lowest castes of Hinduism will do this profession. Now, when they switch over, when they convert to, say, Christianity or Islam, people will continue to insist that they stay in the same profession. The sort of upward mobility that they might have expected in terms of profession or in terms of income does not necessarily accrue to them immediately. It may take a couple of generations before that happens.
So their caste will make it harder to aspire to certain vocations and reach them.
That's right.
And are there any things in kind of personal interactions where a member of one caste would exhibit a certain kind of deference to another?
They used to be in the olden days. I mean, I don't think that happens anymore.
Okay.
You know, for example, in the state of Kerala, there used to be you know, a strict system where if, you know, if there was a member of that, an upper caste and lower caste kind of walking towards each other, the lower caste person is automatically assumed to get out of the way while the upper caste person kind of proceeded on his or her way.
But those days are gone.
So there used to be sort of these little ticks of behavior that that used to be there. But I don't see a lot of them persisting to a large extent at all anymore.
Now, when we had emailed each other, I had asked you for an example of an issue that was viewed differently in India than it might be viewed in America, and you brought up the question of Iran, the tension with Iran, the possibility of war with Iran. How does that look from India's point of view?
Well, this is very interesting because I've been following this for about 2 or 3 months now, especially since Secretary of State Hillary Clinton came to India. Ostensibly on a sort of a regular diplomatic visit, a tour of Asia, but in actuality to kind of persuade India to wean itself off Iranian crude oil. In January, at sort of its peak of imports from Iran, India was actually Iran's biggest customer of crude oil. And so this was, you know, given the sanctions that the United States wishes to impose and has imposed on Iran, this was a problem. And in that context, I mean, I think India has played a fairly delicate and extremely well-played balancing act, while on the one hand continuing to import Iranian crude, although much less than it used to back in January, but on the other hand also sort of persuading the United States that it needs to maintain this relationship with Iran, for several reasons, the first being just sort of a pragmatic need for energy and for crude oil. India's energy needs are booming right now, and it needs all the oil it can get, and Iranian oil is sort of a huge source. But secondly, also, just from a perspective of cultural and historical ties, I mean, India has had long and rich ties with Iran over the years, over the centuries. And India has a large Muslim population as well. So it would not serve government well if it were to sort of sever ties with an Islamic country like Iran.
Yeah, what percentage of your population is Muslim?
India has, I think, the second or the third biggest Muslim population in the world. Indonesia is first. And I believe the number of Muslims in Pakistan and India kind of fluctuate back and forth into the several hundreds of millions, into at least 100 million, if not more. I'll have to look up those figures for you. But it's a large population. It's close to 10 or maybe more percent of the population.
Mm-hmm. Would it actually be that hard to switch your oil dependency? I mean, there are a number of countries that sell oil, right?
Yes, this is true. India imports, I think, close to 80% of all the oil it needs, and India needs a lot of oil. And this, the percentage has been growing. It has very few natural crude oil resources of its own. And Iran being sort of, geographically speaking, Iran is a very cheap place to import oil from, particularly given the sanctions that the rest of the world has imposed on it. Ironically enough, that's working in India's favor because it's able to bargain to buy oil at a better price. Compared to sort of importing oil from Venezuela or from Russia, Iran is well placed to deliver this oil. And Indian tankers, in fact, are now bringing that oil from Iran to India.
So you're getting it at below market prices, in effect, because of the sanctions?
A lower market price, yes. We're able to pay, for example, in rupees. We don't have to pay in U.S. dollars. These are what they call rupee-denominated imports, which mm-hmm. Iran will then have to use to buy other goods from India because rupees can only be used in India. So it works sort of. It's mm-hmm. a huge benefit to India in both ways.
And what is the... what does Hillary Clinton say to you? Is it the case that there are UN sanctions that, in theory, India is compelled to comply with, or is she just asking you to do us a favor and quit buying Iranian oil? I mean, to what extent, in other words, is she making a case from international law?
So far, the case has not been made on an international law basis, I think. I mean... When Secretary of State Clinton came to India a few months ago, it was purely on the basis, she was appealing to India purely on the basis of a bilateral relationship rather than a multilateral one.
And do you know if there were things that were like offered to India in exchange for this, or was it just a vague sense that relations will be better if you do this for us?
There was nothing that was officially offered in the sense nothing was officially made public. But, I did learn that there were offers made of natural gas, for example, from the United States to shoulder some of the burden of the Iranian imports. Of course, I talked to a couple of energy analysts here in India, and, the amount of natural gas that was offered is not nearly enough to make a significant dent in how much oil India imports on a sort of a yearly basis. But I think that was one of the things that was on offer.
Was the offer to actually give India natural gas for free, or
sell India natural gas to kind of reduce its dependence on oil?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And with Iran, does the issue arise at all about a certain parallelism between India's situation and Iran's possible future situation, in the sense that India developed nuclear weapons actually outside of the nuclear non-proliferation regime, right? You were never a member.
That's right.
of the treaty.
That's right.
The situations aren't exactly parallel because Iran is a member. On the other hand, if Iran announced that it was leaving the treaty, as it is allowed to do by the terms of the treaty, and said it was going to develop nuclear weapons, then the situation would be pretty parallel, right? Is there any discussion of that parallel or awareness of it in India?
Just purely based on India's own history, nuclear history, there is an awareness of that. I mean, after India, for example, conducted its first nuclear test in 1975, There were certain sanctions that were imposed. And again, in the late 90s, when another nuclear test was conducted, sanctions were imposed on India, although not to the level that Iran is being sanctioned. I think most of the sanctions on India had to do with nuclear and military technology. And those sanctions have been lifted now in India. In fact, there's been a civilian nuclear energy deal that has been Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's sort of pet project in his term in office over the last, in his two terms in office over the last sort of 8 years. That is still sort of, it's been stuck a little bit on technical matters, but I mean, the United States was clearly eager to have India develop a nuclear energy program, so or a wider nuclear energy program. So India has had nuclear energy for several decades now. You know, the cynics among Indian commentators would say that this is purely to expand the market in India for atomic energy companies in the United States, who would then come back here and sell equipment and sell and offer their expertise and services. But there's no doubt that over the last sort of 12 years, the sanctions that were imposed by the United States have fallen away, and the United States seem to be much more eager now to see India develop a civilian nuclear energy program of its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my own armchair interpretation of that, back when the Bush administration did this thing you're talking about, was that to some extent, it seemed as if we just kind of wanted to do India this favor to strengthen relations as part of a strategy of counterbalancing China, right? That's not something you've heard?
That's something we read about as well, frequently, in fact, it's that the Bush administration in particular and the United States in general was eager to develop India both economically and from a military point of view to act as a counterweight to China in this region.
Mm-hmm. And on Iran, I mean, how does the magnitude of the Iranian threat seem from India's point of view? I mean, within America, there's some debate over whether we aren't, kind of overreacting to the prospect of Iran possibly having a nuclear weapon. In other words, look, India has a nuclear weapon. Israel has nuclear weapons, both of them outside of the non-proliferation regime. Pakistan has them. That's a little more worrisome because of, the internal situation in Pakistan. But the point is that there is a history of people having nuclear weapons for a long time without anything bad happening. What kind of sense is there in India or among different Indians about the perceived threat from Iran to anyone?
Well, I mean, at least among the political parties, I mean, the leading political parties, I don't think there's any ambivalence on exactly what kind of relations India would maintain with Iran. I mean, I think there's sort of a unanimous agreement that Indian relations with Iran are important, and mm-hmm. These two countries have traditionally been friendly, and they should continue to be so. Within the media, there's a certain amount of debate about how much the threat of Iran's nuclear program has played up. One of the journalists I respect most in India, who is the editor of a newspaper called Hindu, argues very strongly and on a regular basis that the United States is actually blowing this out of proportion, and that that these are civilian reactors as opposed to reactors for military purposes that Iran wants to develop. To a certain extent, I would say that a lot of commentators see, this parallel that we talked about, which is that every country, when it reaches a certain stage of development, seeks to, build nuclear reactors purely to further its own industrial and manufacturing sectors to boost its power supplies. And that was definitely the thrust behind the civilian nuclear deal that Manmohan Singh was fighting for such a long time. I think there is a sense, to a certain extent, that the United States may be a little too. I hate to use the word paranoid because that's probably not the case, but a little too wary and a little too cautious of Iran and of every one of its dabbles in the nuclear energy field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me ask you quickly about one domestic story in India, which was a very large power blackout that happened some weeks ago, mm-hmm. I guess 2 or 3 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and you've now recovered from it, but in terms of magnitude, in terms of the number of people who are without power, it was roughly comparable to all of the United States being without power, as I understand.
That's right. And the north and the east, the northern and eastern grids, which is where the power blackout happened, the geography of that, of those two grids, you know, extends to around 600 million people. Not all of them have power on a regular basis in any case. So I think the number of people who ordinarily have electricity who are kind of left without power was about, I would say, maybe 300, 350, 400 million.
So about the population of the United States.
Yeah. About that, yeah.
And what was the cause?
Well, I mean, how the power system is set up in India is that there are state electricity grids, and those are then linked to a national grid. And especially in the summer when, you know, when states draw more power than usual, the national grid imposes certain quotas on each state. I mean, you can only draw so much and no more. And what happened on these two particular instances is that every single state that was linked to this particular section of the national grid exceeded its quota, went above, and so caused the national grid to collapse.
Mm-hmm. And I assume there's been some discussion about creating more insulation between kind of power sectors, between grids?
I think that the concept of interlinking the grids itself, I think, is inescapable, and I don't think there's been any debate about that. You know, there has been debate about making the grid smarter, which means sort of automating it enough to account for fluctuations in power demand and fluctuations in power supply. Also to kind of minimize what are called transmission and distribution losses. India's power grid and the transmission technology is fairly outdated. And so a lot of power is actually lost in simply transferring it from one region to another. The cables lose power on a regular basis. They bleed power. So there has been some talk about sort of restoring and revamping that infrastructure. And there has been, you know, severe censure for the indiscipline of the state power grids, which kind of exceeded their quotas in these two instances.
Okay. Not a lot of deaths that are known to be attributable to this in hospitals or anything?
Not at all, no. I mean, India is used to power shortages in on a much smaller scale, you know, for a couple of hours. So all these hospitals have generators and backup electricity supplies. I think the one thing that did happen that was interesting was there was a case in the state of Jharkhand where a lot of Indian mining happens, where a bunch of miners was trapped underground and they couldn't be winched back up because of a lack of power. But, you know, that ended well. They were all rescued and everything was all right.
Okay. Now, is it true that tomorrow is the 55th anniversary of Indian independence?
The 65th, yes, that's right.
And what kinds of things happen on Independence Day? I would assume it's a big deal?
It is a big deal. You know, there is sort of a ceremony in New Delhi every year, and there is simultaneously there are ceremonies in each of the state capitals. The chief minister raises the flag while the prime minister delivers an address every year. So these are things that are sort of watched, I guess, much less than they used to be. I remember watching these ceremonies on television when I was a kid, but it doesn't seem that people watch it on TV anymore. It's still a big deal. I mean, there are no fireworks ceremonies, unlike in the United States, unfortunately.
Well, I'm sure we'd be willing to export fireworks if that's the problem. What kinds of themes, are there particular themes that are distinctive to Indian history that emerge during Independence Day?
There's a lot of, very reliably, there's a lot of discussion about the independence movement itself and about the leaders of that movement like Jawaharlal Nehru and Mahatma Gandhi. There's a lot of sort of recapitulation of the martyrs and the people who sacrificed so much to have India gain independence. There is also equally predictably a lot of discussion about whether India has lost its way over the last 65 years, whether the ideals that existed and the idealism that existed 1947 still exists now. You know, that's always a healthy debate that always sort of...
Idealism surrounding what kinds of ideals?
You know, in 1947, there was a certain amount of idealism in terms of what India's place in the world should be, what kind of system of moral values the Indian project should uphold. The secular fabric of the country was a big priority in 1947. And the debates that happen now around August 15th every year inevitably happen, they inevitably revolve around whether these three things have been, you know, whether in some sense the country has lost sense of, for example, the secular fabric. You know, India is still a secular country, but it is often beset by communal problems, problems between religions, between Hindus and Muslims in particular. And so these are often dredged up and talked about again and again every year.
Mm-hmm. And what is the sentiment toward the country that independence liberated you from? Well, toward Britain.
I think it's mixed. I mean, I think there's still a lot of people who, there are a lot of extreme views that talk about how the British should never have left, and you know that's always an unpopular position, despite the fact that at least one person voices it every year. But there's a lot of people who view it with mixed feelings. I mean, I know sort of. My grandparents used to talk about very often about the legacies that the British left us, some of which were not necessarily negative. You know, we talk about the Indian railways and the infrastructure that was left behind. We talk about cricket, which India loves and which is most emphatically sort of a British legacy. And so there's a certain fondness, I think, that has crept into the way India views Britain now. Which may not necessarily have been there in the 1940s and 50s when the memories of colonialism were still raw. Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't one of the most important economic legacies fluency in the English language?
I would say so, and there's always there's a healthy debate about that almost all across the year and all through the year about whether that is necessarily a positive or a negative thing, whether the fact that political discourse and a lot of political and economic discourse and a lot of Indian literature that is paid attention to, all of this happens in English, and whether this is happening at the cost of a lot of local Indian languages. And so there's a lot of linguistic parochialism that happens on a daily basis in the political sphere. You know, you have chief ministers of several states, when they campaign for office, they will talk about not necessarily eradicating English, but of boosting the mother tongue of that particular state, and so it's a healthy debate. I mean, there's no way that India looks upon the legacy of English as unequivocally a good thing.
Mm-hmm. But certainly, I mean, these people who have jobs in call centers and provide tech support for Americans, I mean, it's an asset to them, I would think. And I would think, you know, the people who are designing software and stuff find it easier to get plugged into, you know, the appropriate kind of international network by virtue of conversancy in English.
There's no doubt about that. And, you know, if there was, you know, in the debates about the comparative advantages of India versus China, that, you know, the debates that do happen, English is probably at the top of the list in terms of what comparative advantages India holds. You know, a large percentage of the population speaks English. A lot of the education, the medium of instruction is in English, and so these have undoubtedly sort of conferred advantages upon people who are looking for work and looking particularly to engage with the global economy as a whole.
Okay. Well, I guess this provides a natural transition to my last question, which is about Indian views of America. I know this is kind of a broad and vague question, but what does America look like from India these days?
Over the last 2 years, I think the economic slowdown that the entire world, but particularly the United States, has experienced, has definitely sort of shifted. It has exposed a few of America's vulnerabilities to the world in general, but to India in particular. So a lot of people of my age and of my generation who might ordinarily have sought employment in the United States are either coming back to India after studying there, or they're not going abroad in the first place. America was always sort of, you know, traditionally America was a big beacon for a lot of educated upper-class Indians who wanted to work overseas. And I think the nature of that has shifted in particular. But, you know, these things usually have two edges. So while America's vulnerabilities may have been exposed, I think there's a certain amount of sympathy for what a lot of people in America are going through in terms of just not having employment and being constrained financially. It's a tough situation, and a lot of Indians have been there and have felt that. And I think definitely that empathy exists.
But there isn't a sense that you would get maybe in some parts of the Middle East, and certainly I think in your neighbor Pakistan, that America is this country that kind of throws its weight around in an obnoxious way without thinking about the consequences. In other words, there isn't like a lot of resentment.
I'm sure there is. I mean, India is a big country, so I'm sure that view is held by many, many thousands of Indians. You know, I had mentioned before that India has a thriving, left, a political left, and so the communist parties that exist at the national and state levels, you know, for them, America is still, has always been the great Satan and always will be. So they often sort of argue against India's, what they see as India's kowtowing to America's demands. So undoubtedly that view exists, but I don't think at all that it exists among a large or definitely not among the majority of the population. I would say not even among a large section of the population.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, listen, Sama, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sorry about the Olympics, but happy Independence Day.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much.
And I hope you'll be able to come back and talk with us again.
Absolutely. Anytime you want to talk about India, please let me know.
Excellent. Okay. Take care.
Take care. Thank you.